And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hodnell. This is the Ken Hodnell Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, yesterday we were talking about psychics and mediums and wound up talking about Tyler Henry, who is a young man in Hollywood, has a reality show called Hollywood Medium. And he interviews and does readings for a lot of stars. And you can't have any kind of reality show without having a Kardashian on it. Khloe Kardashian sat for a reading. And we're going to be talking about that as we get rolling in the show. As I mentioned yesterday on September 11th, my good friend Rich Forrest died. So, maybe I can get Tyler Henry to do a reading for me about, see what Rich has to say about the other side. Well, today is September the 14th, 257th day of the year. 108 days remain till the end of the year. On this day in 81 A.D., Domitian becomes emperor of the Roman Empire upon the death of his brother Titus. And in those days, and at that rarefied social strata, quite often deaths were not natural. They were murder. 629, Emperor Heraclius enters Constantinople in triumph after he defeated the Persian Empire. Constantinople was the capital of what became known as the Byzantine Empire, which was actually the Eastern Roman Empire. 786, on this date, the Knight of the Three Caliphs, Harun al-Rashid, becomes the Abbasid Caliph upon the death of his brother al-Hadi. And on that same date, there was the birth of Harun's son, al-Mamun. 919, the Battle of Island Bridge. High King Niall Glundub is killed while leading an Irish coalition against the Vikings of Uí Ímair, led by King Cithric Caiche. 1180, the Genpei War, the Battle of Ishibayasuyama in Japan. And it was considered something of an important battle. It was the first battle in which Minamoto Yo Noritomo, who became shogun less than 10 years later, was the commander of the Minamoto forces. Battle was fought on the 14th in the southwest of present-day Odawara, Kanagawa Prefecture, near Yoritomo's headquarters of Kamakura. The there's not a lot of well-known history about some of the machinations in Japan, but as we come across them, we will be sure to discuss them. In 1226, we have the first recorded instance of the Catholic practice of perpetual Eucharistic adoration. It formally began in Avignon, France. Now, for those who are not Catholic, it's a practice in the Western Catholic and some Lutheran traditions in which the Blessed Sacrament is adored by the faithful. Now, this practice may occur either when the Eucharist is exposed or when it's not publicly viewable because it's reserved in a place such as a church tabernacle. Now, adoration is a sign of devotion to and worship of Jesus Christ, who's believed by Catholics to be present in body, blood, soul, and divinity under the appearance of the consecrated host. In other words, the sacramental bread. From a theological perspective, the adoration is a form of latria, based on the tenet of the real presence of Christ in the Blessed Sacrament. Now, how all these customs and practices came in to be is I've always found rather baffling. 1402, the Battle of Hamilden Hill results in an English victory over Scotland. In 1607, flight of the Earls from the Oswelly and Donegal in Ireland. Now, the flight of the Earls took place when Hugh O'Neill, 2nd Earl of Tyrone, and Laurie O'Donnell, the 1st Earl of Tyconnell, and about 90 followers left Ulster and Ireland for mainland Europe. Their permanent exile was a watershed event in Irish history, symbolized the end of the old Gaelic order. It was first named the Flight in a book that was published in 1868 by Reverend C.P. Meehan. Now, historians really disagree over why this took place, but it did. And that pretty much put an end to the Irish resistance at that point in time. 1682, Bishop Gore School, one of the oldest schools in Wales, is founded. And this date in 1723, Grand Master Antonio Manolio de Vilhena lays down the first stone of Fort Mansell in, Manuel in Malta. And the Grand Master referred to was the head of the Knights of Malta. 1741, George Frederick Handel completes his Oratorio Messiah. 1752, the British Empire adopts the Gregorian calendar. Skips 11 days. It went from September 2nd to September 14th. All right. 1763, Seneca warriors defeat British forces in the Battle of Devil's Hole during Pontiac's War. 1782, American Revolutionary War. Review of the French troops under General Rochambeau by General George Washington at Verplanck's Point in New York took place on this date. 1791, the Papal States lose Avignon to Revolutionary France. The Papal States was a separate country ruled by the Pope. 1808, the Finnish War. Russians defeat the Swedes at the Battle of Orvieto. 1812, Napoleonic Wars. The French Grand Army enters Moscow, and the fire of Moscow began as soon as Russian troops leave the city. 1814, the Battle of Baltimore. The poem Defiance of Fort Henry is written on this date by Francis Scott Key, and it was later used as the basis of the Star-Spangled Banner, which people who want so badly to be activists now claim is a racist song. You know, when in doubt, become an activist. Doesn't take any education. You can just run around and scream and carry on like all these lunatics are doing. Another thing I saw this morning that was quite interesting along those lines, a lot of students in college are now saying we don't need to worry about who caused 9/11. We need to concentrate on America's faults. The mere fact that an enemy came in and destroyed the Twin Towers, well, we shouldn't look at that. That's being taken out of context. Now, if we took all those students and sent them to the Middle East, I think they'd have a different attitude. 1829, the Ottoman Empire signs a treaty of Adrianople with Russia, ends the Russo-Turkish War. 1846, Jang Bahadur and his brothers massacre 40 members of the Nepalese palace court. 1862, American Civil War. The Battle of South Mountain, part of the Maryland Campaign, is fought. Now, it's known in several early Southern accounts as the Battle of Boonesboro Gap. And three pitched battles were fought for possession of three South Mountain passes, Crampton's, Turner's, and Fox's Gaps. Major General George McClellan, commanding the Army of the Potomac, needed to pass through these gaps in his pursuit of Robert E. Lee's divided army in Northern Virginia. And although the delay bought at South Mountain allowed him to reunite his army and forestall defeat in detail, Lee considered termination of the Maryland campaign that evening. If you remember, I spoke about the fact that Lee's battle order was found wrapped around some cigars by some Union troops. And McClellan now knew Lee's battle plan. and even with that in his possession, he couldn't beat him. 1901, President McKinley dies after being mortally wounded on September 6th by anarchist Leon Gonzalez and is succeeded by Vice President Theodore Roosevelt. 1901, as I remember the story, the anarchist also wanted a government job and didn't get it. 1911, Russian Premier Boris Storpin is shot by Dmitry Bogrov while attending a performance of Rimsky-Korsakov's The Tale of Tsar Saltanian at the Kiev Opera House in the presence of Tsar Nicholas II. 1914, HMAS AE-1, Royal Australian Navy First Submarine, is lost at sea with all hands near East New Britain in Papua New Guinea. I don't think they ever discovered what happened. It was the first submarine to serve in the Royal Australian Navy. It had been in service less than 7 months. Now, in 1976, search missions began trying to locate the wreck. It was found during the 13th search mission near the Duke of York Islands in December 2017. Now, it was an E-class, which was a version of the preceding D-class submarines, but it was enlarged to accommodate an additional pair of broadside torpedo tubes. 181 feet long, had a beam of 22 feet 6 inches, and it drew 12 feet 6 inches. The complement was 34 men, officers and enlisted. At the outbreak of World War I, the submarine was part of the Australian Navy and Military Expeditionary Force sent to attack German New Guinea. And along with a sister submarine, AE-2, took part in operations leading to the occupation of the German territory. At 7 in the morning on September 14th, the submarine departed Blanche Bay and Rabaul to patrol off Cape Gazelle with HMAS Parramatta. When she didn't get back by 8 o'clock that night, ships were sent to search for her. Rear Admiral Peter Briggs, after the discovery of the submarine in December 2017, said it was likely a diving accident. He said the submarine appears to have struck the bottom with sufficient force to dislodge the fin from its footing, which forced it to hinge forward on its leading edge, impacting the casing, which meant while they could go down, they couldn't go up. And that is a very bad thing for a submarine. 1917, the Russian Empire is formally replaced by the Russian Republic, which was basically a dictatorship under the communists, or the Bolsheviks, as they were called at that time. 1936, Raoul Villain, who assassinated the French socialist Jean Jaurès, is himself killed by Spanish Republicans in Ibiza. 1939, World War II, the Estonian military boards the Polish submarine ORP Orzel and Tallinn, sparking a diplomatic incident that the Soviet Union later used to justify the annexation of Estonia. 1940, the Ip Massacre. Hungarian army, supported by local Hungarians, killed 158 Romanian civilians in Ip, Szalaj, a village in northern Transylvania. It was considered an act of ethnic cleansing, and that's when the majority decides to wipe out all the members of the minority ethnic group. 1943, World War II. The Wehrmacht starts a three-day retaliatory operation targeting several Greek villages in the region of Vianos. The death toll would eventually exceed 500. You didn't have to do anything wrong. You just had to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. 1944, World War II. Maastricht becomes the first Dutch city to be liberated by Allied forces. 1948, the Indian Army captures the city of Aurangabad as part of Operation Polo. Operation Polo was the code name for the Hyderabad police action of the then newly independent Dominion of India against Hyderabad state. Military operation in which the Indian Armed Forces invaded the Nizam-ruled princely state and annexed it into the Indian Union. At the time of the partition in 1947, the princely states, and there was more than one, of India, who in principle had self-government within their own territories, were subjected to subsidiary alliances with the British, which gave them control of their external relations. In the Indian Independence Act of 1947, the British abandoned all these alliances, leaving the states with the option of opting for full independence. However, by 1948, almost all these princely states had ceded to either India or Pakistan. And one major exception was the wealthiest and most powerful principality, Hyderabad, where the Nizam Mir Sir Osman Al Khan, Asif Jahad VII, the Muslim ruler who presided over a largely Hindu population, chose independence and hoped to maintain this with an irregular army recruited from the Muslim aristocracy. They were known as the Razakars. Well, unfortunately, he had quite a bit of problem, and eventually they were stomped into the dirt by the Indian Army. 1954, in a top-secret nuclear test, a Soviet Tu-4 bomber drops a 40-kiloton atomic weapon just north of Tatskoye village. 1958, the first two German post-war rockets designed by the German engineer Ernst Mayr reached the upper atmosphere. They were takeoffs of the V-2. 1959, the Soviet probe Lunar 2 crashes onto the moon, becoming the first man-made object to reach it that we know about. 1960, the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, OPEC, is founded on this date. Also in 1960, the Congo crisis. Mobutu Sese Seko seizes power in a military coup, suspends parliament and the constitution. That's where all the mercenaries' armies became active. 1975, the first American saint, Elizabeth Ann Seton, is canonized by Pope Paul VI. Yes, he waves his hand over somebody and they become a saint. 1979, Afghan leader Nur Muhammad Taraki is assassinated on the order of Hafizullah Amin, who becomes the new General Secretary of the People's Democratic Party. Whenever you hear People's Democratic Party, you know you're talking about a communist dictatorship. 1982, President-elect of Lebanon, Bakir Gamayel, is assassinated. 1984, Joe Kittinger becomes the first person to fly a gas balloon alone across the Atlantic Ocean. 1985, Penang Bridge, the longest bridge in Malaysia, connects the island of Penang to the mainland. It opens for traffic on this date. 1989, the standard gravure shooting where Joseph Westbecker, a 47-year-old pressman, killed 8 people and injured 12 others at his former workplace, Standard Gravure, before committing suicide, happened on this date. 1992, the Constitutional Court of Bosnia and Herzegovina declares the breakaway Croatian Republic of Herzeg-Bosnia to be illegal. You know, we've all heard, and it's been drummed into us, for my lifetime at least, that judges have complete and total immunity. They can say and do the craziest things from the bench, and they're immune. I found out that's not true. In fact, the U.S. Supreme Court has said that. If a judge oversteps his authority, he can be nailed just like the rest of us. 1993, Lufthansa Flight 2904, an Airbus A320, crashes into an embankment after overshooting the runway at Okeci International Airport. That's now the Warsaw Chopin Airport. Kills 2 people. 1994, the Major League Baseball season is canceled because of a strike. You play a game, you get paid a fortune to play the game, and you want more. 1997, 81 people killed as 5 bogeys of the Ahmedabad Hara Express plunge into a river in Bilaspur district in Madhya Pradesh in India. 1998, telecommunications companies MCI Communications and WorldCom complete their $37 billion merger to form MCI WorldCom. 1999, Kiribati, Nauru, and Tonga join the United Nations. 2000, on this date, Microsoft releases Windows Me. I used it. Not impressed. 2001, historic national prayer service held at Washington National Cathedral for victims of the September 11 attacks. Similar service is held in Canada on Parliament Hill, the largest vigil ever held in the nation's capital. 2003, in a referendum, Estonia approves joining the European Union. 2007, financial crisis of 2007-08. The Northern Rock Bank experiences the first bank run in the UK in 150 years. The bank run is when everybody rushes down and tries to draw out all their funds. 2015, the first observation of gravitational waves is made, announced by the LIGO and Virgo collaborations on February 11, 2016. And in 2019, Yemen's Houthi rebels claim responsibility for an attack on Saudi Arabian oil facilities. Yeah, let's see what else. A lot of births and deaths on this date in history. Holidays and observances. Christian Feast Day. Alleluia, Flacia in the Eastern Orthodox Church. Cormac MacQuinnan, Crescentius of Rome. Feast of the Cross in Christianity and an Eastern Orthodox Church. Elevation of the Holy Cross. Formerly, the Wednesday, Friday, and Saturday following September 14th were observed as one of the four sets of Ember Days in the Irish calendar. They were known as the Quarter Tents in the Roman Catholic and Anglican churches. Lord of Miracles of Buga, Louis Gabriel Torin Dufrizi, one of the martyr saints in China. Matamus of Cologne, not Burga. Engineers Day in Romania, Hindi Day in the Hindi-speaking states of India. Mobilized Servicemen's Day in Ukraine, and in Nicaragua, San Jacinto Day. Well, that having finished our history segment, we were talking about the fact that there's a lot of mediums and seers out there, psychics, whatever you want to call them. And Tyler Henry is one of the best known. He had a TV show on, called Hollywood Medium. And a lot of stars lined up to, and not so stars, stars in their own mind perhaps. Among them was Khloe Kardashian. Well, she sat for a reading. And according to Tyler Henry, family patriarch Robert Kardashian had a message for his youngest daughter. There was a feeling of like, I don't want you to be there when I'm actually passing away. He said, for your sake, I want you to just not have that in your memory. So no Kardashian kids were present when their father died in 2003. And that was something they claim only the family knew. Now you have to ask yourself, I've seen a lot of, if you've ever been to a carnival where you see somebody get up on the stage and start doing all kinds of things and giving messages, and you have to ask yourself, how do they know that information? Well, if you're very good at reading people, quite often you can get a lot of that information from body language. And then, of course, there are those that are so intent and so firmly believe that they tell their entire life story without any prompting from the so-called medium. I've only met one, maybe two, that I would call actual, honest-to-God psychics. One of them's a former naval officer who was a good friend of mine. I think he's still alive. I haven't seen him in a while. But he was so accurate, he was scary. Now, in addition to, and of course, we went and saw George Edwards. George Edwards? At an event in, I think it was in Albuquerque. And he was unbelievable. How much was real and how much was ringers in the audience is anybody's guess. Now, there's other methods of divination that people have used over the years. One of my favorites is the Ouija board. Now, this is more a product of mass marketing than it is of the paranormal. The Ouija board began in the 1890s as a $1.50 game to bring the family close together and to let them have a peek into the great beyond. Players place their fingers on a teardrop-shaped planchette that seemingly moves by itself over the word yes and no and the letters and numbers. A lot of researchers credit the ideomotor effect in which the subconscious causes the muscles to act. I did that with a very attractive young lady when I was in college. And primarily I did it just to play kneesies with her. But she was having a lot of headaches, and according to the Ouija board, it was because of a fall she had, and she went home and had it checked out, and it was absolutely correct. Then we have the Celtic Ogham. Now, modern-day druids and neo-pagans, but playing kneesies with her was quite exciting. And neo-pagans took to the curious Ogham symbols. That was an early medieval alphabet for the Irish language from the 4th to the 6th centuries. And they used it as tools for divination. And according to old Irish folklore, the alphabet was invented shortly after the collapse of the Tower of Babel. Now, for those that don't know, remember the story of the Tower of Babel. At one point in time, everybody spoke the same language. And they decided they wanted to be like God, so they built a tower that went up into the air. And God caused the tower to collapse. And after that, everybody didn't speak the same language. Then we have palm reading, also called palmistry. This probably originated in India, where folks told fortunes by reading the shapes and lines in the hands. And it's been practiced since ancient times by a lot of cultures. Now, while the entire hand is studied, modern palmists mostly focus on what's called the heart line, the head line, and the lifeline to interpret a person's health, romantic, and economic futures. Then one that I watched with utter fascination was a pendulum divination. Answers to simple yes-no questions about important matters, such as, will I find love and should I take the job? Is this a good investment? Or said to be founded by interpreting the subtle differences in the motion and the action of a swinging pendulum. Many years ago, like 50, my parents owned a motel in Florida. And one of the buildings on that property was a cottage set off by itself. And it was rented long-term to a family that was said to be gypsies. Their daughter, who was cute as a bug, did a lot of divination using a pendulum. She also showed me how to do it using playing cards. But she was incredibly accurate. Not 100%, but quite a bit. Then we have Viking ruins, or runes, I guess is there it's pronounced. These letters are used by Germanic languages before the Latin alphabet was introduced. Now, the first runic inscriptions are a mystery, but it was said to have been used as magical signs on charms. Now, the word rune actually means secret or something hidden. And I've seen a lot of charms for sale at various psychic events that have runes on them. And then one thing, that there used to be a tea room in New York City when we lived there, where this lady went around the room and read tea leaves. And when tea first arrived in England from China, people started studying the dregs for insights into the past, present, and future. That practice is known as tassiography. And they do that the same way they've looked for meaningful patterns in coffee grounds, wine settlements, and splatters of molten wax and lead. And then one that I've played with quite a lot is tarot cards. Now, this began as a card game called Tarocchi in northern Italy in the late 14th century. The deck over the centuries adopted carnival-inspired images of the fool, death, and other characters, but it wasn't used for magical purposes until the late 18th centuries. And I've seen a lot of accurate predictions come from a deck of tarot cards used by somebody that knows what they're doing. Then, of course, we have astrology. Now, for many years, people didn't differentiate between astronomy and astrology. They believed that the movements of the stars and planets can be predicted, then you can also predict human affairs. Once used by leaders to make decisions of great importance, astrology is now widely seen as a what you might call a pseudoscience. I watched a young man at a psychic fair have a line that never got below 10 people of folks waiting to have him plot their horoscope using astrology. Then there's numerology. That's a study of numbers. Numerology posits that certain numbers speak of personal traits, and it can be used to predict the future and give life meaning. And then we have crystal balls. First recorded use of spherical objects for mystical purposes was by the Druids of Britain, Ireland, and Gaul, who would fall into a trance while gazing into a polished ball of mineral called beryl. Traveling carnivals in the U.S. and Europe brought crystal ball readers to and bangles and scarves, and they all claimed to be gypsies. Maybe, maybe not. Well, one question that I've heard asked a lot. What happens during a near-death experience? There are those that claim that the afterlife is a wonderful place, and there are others that claim that while I guess you could call it temporarily dead, the burning pits of hell. Even Ernest Hemingway had an incident like that. When a World War I mortar shell struck 18-year-old Ernest Hemingway as he drove a Red Cross ambulance along the Italian front, he was so severely wounded with shrapnel that he actually died and came back. He said, "I felt my soul or something coming right out of my body, like he'd pulled a silk handkerchief out of a pocket by one corner." Well, when he described this situation, he was describing a classic near-death experience, an out-of-body event like watching a movie of oneself from a distance. And it was a 2014 movie called Heaven is for Real, based on a best-selling book. And that told the story of a boy who believes he visited heaven during surgery. Now, I just had spinal surgery, and I didn't go anywhere. The experiences are recounted by people representing a wide spectrum of ages and cultural backgrounds and religions. And most of them describe it as realer than real. They're not fantasies or delusions. They think it actually took place. Now, some have reported visions of dead loved ones or spirits or even a bright light taking the form of a beacon at the end of a tunnel. Or maybe a flash of brightness, like a marquee. The most frequently described experience reported by over 80% of people who have reported having near-death experiences may be the most comforting. An overwhelming feeling of calm, even bliss, to the point they'll never look at death again the same way. Now, according to Scientific American, near-death experiences are triggered during what are called singular life-threatening episodes, shock, asphyxia, blunt force trauma. Fully 10% of patients have heart attacks in a hospital report near-death experiences. Stony Brook University School of Medicine in New York did a study on cardiac patients, suggests the experiences may go beyond the familiar. Interviews with 101 cardiac patients whose hearts stopped, making them momentarily dead, reveal that the people sensed fear, saw animals or plants, suffered violence and persecution, and experienced a sense of deja vu, and remembered things that happened after they had had their initial heart attack. Stony Brook critical care physician Sam Parnia told BBC in 2015, "It seems like the mental experience of death is much broader than what's been assumed in the past." Now, while many people have similar experiences, their interpretations are shaped by their beliefs and backgrounds. Some see Jesus, some see Krishna, some see aliens. Either way, scientists believe it all comes down to brain chemistry. According to British neuroscientist Dean Mobbs, many of the phenomena associated with near-death experiences can be biologically explained. In 2011, he did a work called Trends in Cognitive Sciences. The light at the end of the tunnel vision may be explained, for instance, by the eyes not getting enough blood and oxygen, so they have very, very narrow vision. Now, understanding near-death experiences can even help bring back more patients back from death. The Atlantic reported that surgeons can recreate a common near-death experiences. People whose pulses stopped when buried in snow or falling into icy water and then have their pulses started again by chilling the patient's bodies or stopping their hearts before long, complicated, and dangerous surgeries or leaving severely wounded people in that blissful limbo between life and death while they recover may have beneficial effects. One study found comparisons between near-death experiences and how the brain responds to a psychoactive drug called ketamine, which first used as anesthesia in the Vietnam War. In improper dosages, it caused hallucinations that have been abused as a date rape drug. But scientists say ketamine can also be used to give terminally ill patients a preview of death to relieve their anxieties. If nothing else, a near-death experience can fuel the literary imagination. Hemingway drew on his experience for his 1929 classic, A Farewell to Arms. Well, there's been a lot of individuals who claim that during surgeries where their heart stopped, they actually found themselves looking down at their body laying on the operating table. There was a singer by the name of Pam Reynolds. She had recorded with Bruce Springsteen and Pearl Jam. She was promoting a new album in 1991 when she suddenly lost the ability to speak. What had happened, she had an aneurysm in her brain stem that threatened to kill her at any moment. The only solution was a dangerous operation that called for chilling her body and draining the blood from her head. She was well into the surgery when her brain waves and blood flow suddenly stopped. She was clinically dead. And in that condition, she says she heard a musical note and felt herself levitate over the operating room. With what you might call hyperfocus, she could watch herself from above being operated on below and hear the doctors and nurses discussing her arteries. She then went down that familiar tunnel and saw the bright light and talked with her dead grandmother and uncle before they brought her back to the hospital. She said the whole time she was in this state, she heard the song Hotel California by the Eagles. She said her uncle pushed her, laughing. When I hit the body, the line in the song you can check out anytime you like, but you can never leave. She said, when I opened my eyes, she said, you know, that's really insensitive. After what she called the most pleasant experience, skeptics questioned she really had flatlined or is claimed, or if those visions occurred while she was under general anesthetic and her brain was still active. Well, she died at age 53 of heart failure, 19 years after that particular incident. Well, now, another famous individual who claims that he almost died and had a near-death experience was George Foreman. Now, he was the, if you remember, he was the boxing champion. He didn't see any bright lights, friendly faces of departed friends. There was no gentle levitation. For George Foreman, he said coming close to dying just plain hurt. The experience that would shake up his world played out after a boxing match on a hot, humid night in Puerto Rico in 1977, with the air conditioner in the arena broken. His opponent, Jimmy Young, a skilled boxer who had lost to Muhammad Ali in a controversial decision, endured a 7-round pounding and Foreman's constant pushing and holding before landing a knockdown blow in the 12th that led to the winning decision. As he headed to the dressing room, the former world heavyweight champion and Olympic gold medalist started shaking uncontrollably and vomiting before he collapsed from a concussion and heat stroke. In his 2007 memoir, God in My Corner, he said, I was transported into a deep, dark void like a bottomless pit. I knew I was dead, and this sure wasn't heaven. He said, I was suspended in emptiness with nothing over my head or under my feet. This was a place of total isolation, cut off from everything and everybody. It could only be described as a vacant space of extreme hopelessness. He said he could literally smell death, and for the first time in his life, he prayed. After that, he found God, became a minister, and successful entrepreneur. If you remember, he's been pitching for a long time what he calls the George Foreman Grills before returning to the ring to become champion again in 1995. As sports historian Andrew Smith wrote in No Way But to Fight, George Foreman in the Business of Boxing, he said that because of that near-death experience, he started to come alive again. Well, you have to ask yourself, what happens when you die? For Elizabeth Taylor, she met her dead husband. You know, of her many medical crises, one stood out above all the others for actress Elizabeth Taylor. Undergoing back surgery in 1962, she stopped breathing for 5 minutes and was pronounced clinically dead. As doctors scrambled to revive her, the actress felt her soul leaving her body and traveling into a tunnel where she met her third husband, Mike Todd, who died in a 1958 plane crash. He told her to go back to the living. You have to fight to go back. You have so much more to do, and you have to fight. And she did, returning from what she called the other side to the world of the living with no more fear of death. As she told ABC News, Diane Sawyer, adjusting to life again was like learning to walk all over, but, and I started appreciating sounds and colors and music, and I thought, my God, I've taken all this for granted, and it's so incredibly beautiful. This was one of Taylor's first brush with death, and it wouldn't be her last. Her many ailments garnering so much media attention as her storied seven-decade career as a two-time Academy Award-winning actress, humanitarian and AIDS activist. Everybody's got to be an activist, don't you know? If you're not an activist, you haven't had the full gamut. She spent much of her final years in a wheelchair before dying in 2011 at age 79 of congestive heart failure. She told Larry King in 2001, "There must be some reason God wants me to live. Must be something left for me to do. And I got to find out what that is and go do it." Well, what's interesting is when you deal with the human mind and the brain, there's so many unanswered questions. And those that are most effective seem to be kids. There's a lot of children, young children who talk about having past lives, dying and going to heaven and coming back. Now, there's stories of people claiming to have had past lives that are as perplexing as they are well documented. Now, once considered the realm of religion and metaphysics, reincarnation is now getting serious consideration by scientists who believe the explanation may lie in the complicated realm of quantum physics. In fact, research has shown that matter such as electrons and protons behave differently when it's observed, suggesting the physical world is shaped by the very non-physical phenomenon of consciousness rather than the other way around. If you go a step further, consciousness may not even require the physical world to exist. Indeed, it may not even require a brain and can be transferred to another brain even after death, which would explain reincarnation. But ask yourself this, why do more kids than adults report memories of a past life? Child psychiatrist Jim Tucker, leading expert on reincarnation and children's anomalous memories, is documenting what he calls carryover memories. These are found in children 2 to 6 who are able to recount because of a less filtered access to their unconscious, their brains having not yet reached a stage of development when reasoning takes shape. When he wrote in Virginia Magazine, he said, "I understand the leap it takes to conclude there's something beyond what we can see and touch. But there is evidence that needs to be accounted for, and when we look at these cases carefully, it's clear some sort of carryover of memories often makes the most sense." And there's been a lot of very unusual cases involving children. There was a young child named Lee, and it was strange enough when he started asking about going to his other house with his other mommy. And then he got upset with his parents because he needed to return to work. He was 2.5 years old at the time. When little Lee started talking about his daughter named Jennifer, and his middle name was Cole, even though it wasn't, and he was born on June 26th when his birthday was, in fact, June 21st. His parents got the unusual idea maybe he was talking about a past life. Well, the icing on the cake, so to speak, was when Lee started obsessing about all things Hollywood. Gone with the Wind wasn't just his favorite movie. He said he wrote it before he died at age 48. It was written by... When the family researched the film, they found it was written by Sidney Cole Howard, who got an Academy Award for it in 1940. Unfortunately, he died in 1939 at the age of 48, just 2 months after his June 26th birthday. Startling as this was, since Lee couldn't provide any information unavailable online, a lot of folks said that case was unresolved, but certainly intriguing. Now, Gone with the Wind was made from a movie from a book written by Margaret Mitchell, but the movie was written by Sidney Cole Howard. Now, I doubt a 2.5-year-old could go online and find all that. But then again, you don't know. Well, then we have a case that Mahatma Gandhi actually investigated. When Shanti Devi of Delhi, India, was 4 years old in 1930, she told her parents she lived in Mathura, 90 miles to the south, with a merchant husband who wore glasses, had a fair complexion and a wart on his left cheek, and they had a shop next to the temple. Her parents naturally dismissed all these claims as childhood fantasies. I mean, most kids have had imaginary friends that they played with. But Devi continued to insist that they were true. By age six, she was speaking words from a Mathura dialect she'd never learned, telling her teachers her husband's name was Kedarnath and that his wife had died in 1925, 10 days after giving birth. Well, investigation showed there really was a Kedarnath from Mathura whose wife, Luji Devi, did die 10 days after giving birth to a son. Tracked down by the headmaster, Kedar traveled to Delhi posing as his brother to meet Devi. She immediately recognized him and the son and shared details about their family. Well, this peculiar situation reached the administration of India leader Mahatma Gandhi, whose government conducted an official investigation. And that investigation concluded in 1936 that Shanti Devi was a reincarnation of Ludi Devi, though subsequent reports were split on the matter. Well, then we have a man who claimed he was a reincarnation of Franz Liszt. Well, this raises the question, where does genius come from? In the 1950s, an English boy named David Seacomb was convinced his prodigious talents at the piano carried over his previous life as Hungarian composer and pianist Franz Liszt. I mean, let's face it, how else could he explain how easily he taught himself to piano? Saying he didn't have any time for lessons. By 21, he was known as the Paganini of the piano, filling concert halls. By then, he had convinced himself he was the reincarnation of Liszt, a contemporary of Chopin and Wagner, who died in 1886 after a celebrated career and also included composing, arranging, and teaching. By now calling himself Vladimir Levinsky, Seacomb developed a reputation as an eccentric, wearing a monocle, long wool coat, and jackboots as his stage behavior became more unusual. He'd stray from the program, perform unique interpretations of popular works. Well, in 1952, he stopped midway into a performance to talk about Liszt. His health declined, and he died in a nursing facility. He was only in his 30s. Well, then we have the case of John and Florence Pollock of Hexham, England, who were devastated. On May 5th, 1957, their two daughters, Joanna, 11, and Jacqueline, 6, were killed in a car accident. The next year, on October 4th, 1958, Florence gave birth to twin girls. That's when the couple's grief turned to confusion. Although the babies, who they named Gillian and Jennifer, are identical twins, they had different birthmarks, which is unusual. Hauntingly, Jennifer's birthmark on her waist resembled one that her dead sister Jacqueline had, and a second birthmark on her forehead looked just like Jacqueline's scar. Well, when the twins were 2 years old, they asked their parents for toys that their older sisters had played with, the toys that the twins had never seen. Then when the family, which had moved, returned to their hometown of Hexham, the twins spotted landmarks they'd never before seen when they suddenly panicked at the traffic. One exclaimed, "That car is coming to get us!" Well, as the girls got older, their past life memories faded. Whatever caused the resurrection of memories apparently does have a shelf life. How about the story of the little white boy from Ohio? It was the reincarnation of a black woman who died in a Chicago hotel fire. That's what Luke Ruhlman of Ohio started telling his mother when he was 2 years old, babbling on about a woman named Pam. She finally asked him who Pam was, and he looked at her and said, "Well, I was." He said that when he was 5 years old. He said, "Well, I used to be, but I died, and I went up to heaven, saw God, and eventually God pushed me back down, and I was a baby, and you named me Luke. When Luke said he had once gone by train to Chicago, something the family had never done, his mother looked into her son's story. Nobody named Pam in the family that she knew of, but she did find out that a Pam Robinson was among 19 people who died in a hotel fire in Chicago in 1993. You know, interestingly enough, studies show 60% of children who claim past life memories are actually male. And on that note, one day when his father was changing his diaper, an 18-month-old boy named Sam told his father, "When I was your age, I used to change your diaper." One of the case studies in psychiatrist Jim Tucker's research revolved around a child named Sam, who seemed to be convinced he was the reincarnation of his own grandfather. When looking through a photo album, Sam, who'd never seen a picture of his grandfather, pointed to a picture and said, "That's my car." And he actually pointed to his grandfather's car. When his skeptical mother showed Sam pictures of the grandfather as a young boy, the other children, Sam pointed to one of the boys and said, "There I am." And in fact, he had pointed out his grandfather. When his mother told him that, he said, "No, that's me." And finally, Sam told his mother that in his past, some bad men turned my sister into a fish, which startled his mother. Sam's grandfather's sister had been murdered and dumped in the water. Nobody had ever told the child that story. So how did he know? Well, from past lives remembered, let's talk about something a little more down to earth, so to speak. Alien encounters. When somebody reports an encounter with an alien, are these true contacts with foreign beings? You know, these stories always seem too far out in left field to be true, but in many cases, the evidence does support them. For example, let's talk about the case of Betty and Barney Hill. They claim to have been abducted by ETs. Took place September 19, 1961, on a clear night with a bright moon. Betty and Barney Hill were driving along a remote New Hampshire highway with the radio playing when Betty suddenly spotted a strange light in the sky descending toward them. And then it came down to hover right in front of their car. During an interview Betty had with PBS Nova, Barney got out with the binoculars in an attempt to see what the craft was. As he looked up, he could see a row of men standing in the windows looking down at him. Then the craft began to descend, and he had a feeling they were going to abduct him. Although they got home, Betty had dreams that human-like beings in dark uniforms and caps with gray skin, big eyes, blue lips, and big noses had led him into a flying saucer. They were separated and examined. The beings scraped away Betty's skin, took fingernail samples, and probed her belly button with a needle before putting them back in their car. Betty was always remembered as the first lady of UFOs and the grandmother of all abductions. Though she was not the first abduction by a long shot, she was one of the most popularized. Under hypnosis, Barney gave a similar account, saying that out of fear he kept his eyes closed the entire time because he could feel the presence of the aliens around him. He said, "I felt like the eyes had pushed into my eyes. I'm not even afraid that they're not connected to a body. They're just there. They're just up close to me, pressing against my eyes." The Hill story would become the first widely publicized account of a UFO abduction, which led to a series of reported alien encounters and actually fueled a craze that continues to this day. and the couple would be given extra credibility when they had originally reported their encounter to Air Force officials, both respected as citizens. Barney was employed by the U.S. Postal Service, and Betty was a social worker. Now, the couple did not seem to have any interest in publicity. They were simply telling stories best they could. But once the tale became public in 1963, the Hills came out as celebrities. They inspired the 1966 bestseller by James Earl Jones, The Interrupted Journey, and the 1975 TV film The UFO Incident, with James Earl Jones and Estelle Parsons playing the Hills. And there have been numerous TV specials. Now, Barney died at 46 of a cerebral hemorrhage, 8 years after the incident, and Betty kept their story alive in interviews and speeches throughout her life. She died at age 85 in 2004. She would even draw a star map she said was based on a map of trade routes shown to her by the being that called himself the Leader. Now, some researchers said her map appeared to depict the star system Zeta Reticuli, which is located 39.17 light-years from Earth. Now, over the years, the Hills' account would face great skepticism. The couple had been dead, tired during their long drive. Drank coffee in a Vermont diner at 10 p.m. before setting out on the final leg when they were supposed to have run into the UFO. Skeptics suggested in their exhaustion they mistook an aircraft warning beacon atop a mountain as the UFO. And their false memories, they claimed, were shaped by Betty's dreams, which she shared with her husband, which were later recovered during hypnosis. Other critics suggested the Hills simply made the whole thing up. One of the most provocative suggestions was their stories under hypnosis stemmed from the stress of being an interracial couple. Barney was black and Betty was white, in a predominantly white region during a turbulent time in American history. Well, among the most prominent skeptics was renowned astronomer Carl Sagan, who said that Betty's star map was nothing more than a random collection of points with lines drawn to suggest a star system. Of course, Carl Sagan himself had a lot to be to explain, which he never did. Now, in tomorrow's show, we're going to talk about Jesse Marcel. I got to know his son fairly well, Jesse Marcel Jr. Jesse Marcel, if you remember, was the G2, or the intelligence officer, at Roswell Army Air Force Base, who went and picked up the wreckage of the whatever crashed at Roswell. Now, he wrote a journal that many people believe holds the secret to the key to the Roswell secrets. The only problem is it was written in a code that only the major himself knew. And we're going to be talking about Roswell at some length. I used to speak there for 10 years until Don Smith decided I wasn't politically acceptable because I outsold him without even trying to. And if you didn't buy a Don Smith book, you were clearly ignorant, was his attitude. Well, until tomorrow, this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show, saying have a truly great evening.